Welcome to The Vampire Squid, a podcast about increasing transparency and education in finance. This is your host, Alan Lee, and welcome to episode 20 of The Vampire Squid. Boy, do I have an exciting episode for you guys today, and just want to take a second to reflect that this is our 20th episode. I can't believe that it's already been, I believe, 3 months, and this podcast has come so far, and I couldn't have done it without all of your help and support and giving me feedback, reviewing on iTunes, listening to the podcast on a weekly basis. Thank you guys so much. So for this 20th episode, I have on a very special guest for our venture capital episode, and I have on Charlie O'Donnell, who is the founder of Brooklyn Bridge Ventures. And Brooklyn Bridge Ventures invests in early stage startups in the New York community. And just a quick background on who Charlie O'Donnell is. He was the first analyst at Union Square Ventures, which is probably the most famous VC in New York. But he was the first analyst there with Fred Wilson, who I'm sure many of you know and follow his blog, AVC. I know I'm a follower as well. But Charlie was the first analyst at Union Square Ventures. He then went on to First Round Capital, another very prominent venture capital firm in New York. And he then later started Brooklyn Bridge Ventures. And he's invested in things throughout his tenure in First Round and Brooklyn Bridge and companies like GroupMe, which I'm sure many of you use, and Canary, which is an IoT startup company. So, I mean, I can go on and on about his background, but this was a very fun and engaging interview, and it was over an hour long. So I'm going to actually break up this interview into two sections, and next week's episode will be part two of the interview. But throughout this interview, we cover things from his decision-making process of studying finance, going to venture capital, doing the entrepreneurship route, starting his own fund, and talking a lot about the insights that he has learned, which I think could be very helpful for those of you that are interested in venture capital or looking to break into venture capital or just learning to learn a little bit more about, you know, what venture capitalists do on a day-to-day basis. So I hope that you guys enjoy this episode, and as always, if you have any questions, comments, suggestions, please feel free to visit me at thevampiresquid.com and you can contact me there. And also, I will provide links to Charlie's contact info and blog in case you guys have any questions and want to reach out to him yourself. He's a, you know, very funny, very engaging, very knowledgeable person, and I'm, you know, very happy and excited that I had the chance to interview him in person. This is your host, Sam Lee, and welcome to episode 20 of The Vampire Squid. I have on a very special guest with me today, Charlie O'Donnell, who is the founder of Brooklyn Bridge Ventures. Charlie, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, we'd love to just dive in since I know we're a little bit short on time, but I know that a lot of my listeners are currently thinking about pursuing venture capital or pursuing entrepreneurship, but just wanted to go back into a little bit earlier when you were deciding in college your major and what made you decide to go into finance and what decision process was like.
Sure. So I grew up in New York. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Bensonhurst out in Brooklyn. And, you know, when you grow up in New York, finance looms large, right? Wall Street, both of my brothers were brokers. And that was where successful people seemed to go. And, you know, my parents were really into education. There's quite a significant age gap between me and my brothers. And so my parents, I think, kind of felt like we should really focus on this one and make sure he gets all the right education and help him through, you know, school and tests and quizzes and all that sort of stuff. And so, you know, and that Wall Street felt like a good fit because I was, into math, and I had an interest in the stock market because my godfather gave me some IBM stock when I was born. And so I knew I had like a handful of shares in an account somewhere. And, you know, the way financial journalism went in the 80s was kind of like, you know, as part of your local news broadcast, they'd say, oh, IBM went up today or IBM went down today. Like, they don't do that anymore because they know it's on your phone and an app and it's not a relevant part of the broadcast. But having a stock that everybody sort of followed, even from a young age, I was like, oh, you know, this went up or IBM stinks, you know, like, or the whole market's terrible in 1987. And I was like 8 years old and saw, you know, the value of my stock go down by like 30%. And so it was something I always followed. And thought I would continue with that as I stayed local. I went to Fordham. I majored in finance when I was there. But the sort of parallel track that was going on is my dad brought a computer into our house in 1987. And so, you know, at 8 years old, I kind of stopped writing my school reports and started typing them. And, you know, we early Prodigy users and, you know, started seeing what was sort of on their intranet and then out on the internet and realizing that sort of tech was a thing.
And this was the beginning of the dial-up.
Exactly. And, your parents would pick up the phone and, no, put the phone back down.
I remember.
And so, and at the same time, you know, I was in college in the late 90s. And so I was a finance major in college. I had a paid internship in finance, which I'll go into in a second. So I was, and I got a scholarship. So I was sort of net cash flow positive. And so I said, oh, well, maybe I'll put some money into some stocks. And at the time, if you put money into some stocks in 1997, like you look like a genius because everything went up. And, you know, thought I was smarter than I was and started getting into some of the dot-com stuff. And, you know, so I was interested in tech and growth investing and internet and all that sort of stuff. I started reading Kara Swisher's columns in the Wall Street Journal. She wrote a column called Boomtown at the time. And
I listened to her podcast.
She had
Bill Gurley on a few weeks ago.
Absolutely terrific. Yeah. And I emailed her when I was still an intern. And I said, you know, I really appreciate your stories and humanizing this, you know, this whole tech industry. And I invited her to come and speak at Fordham if she was ever in New York. And she came.
That's great.
The embarrassing thing was, like, I don't think anybody at Fordham really understood, like, who she was. This was pre-Facebook, so marketing an event was not the easiest thing in the world. So we, like, rented out the campus library, you know, auditorium, a room for like 200 people, and like maybe I got 30. And I think in hindsight, I'm trying to push it. Like, it was probably like 15.
Is this the your flyering?
Flyers and all that sort of stuff, right? And, but she was super gracious about it and, you know, had an interesting discussion with the audience. And, you know, but that, you know, being able to reach people like that, it was just really inspiring and got me very interested. And so, when they're at my internship, I happened to get an internship at the General Motors Pension Fund. So basically, my high school had a program where in the third semester of senior year, they kicked us out. They basically said, you've applied to your school. You're not going to do any real work from February until the rest of the year. So why don't you go do something productive? And which was great. I mean, I went to Regis High School. It was a scholarship school here in the city. It's one of the best high schools in the country. And they gave me this great opportunity. And so, you know, I worked at GM, and one of the initial things was they asked me whether or not I knew how to use Excel. And because I had had a computer in the home for the last 10 years, I was like, yeah, sure, I know how to use Excel. And I got all the awesome projects and started building models and really got to work with a lot of great folks over there. And bounced around through a number of different asset classes because, you know, as a college freshman, there aren't really a lot of paid internships for college freshmen. So I kept going back to the same place where I was at the summer before and just reaching out to an individual group and say, okay, hey, so-and-so, like, can I do something in fixed income this summer, or can I do something in real estate or the trading room? And so I got to bounce around to all of the aspects of an institutional investor and got to see a lot of different aspects of different asset classes. The one group that I hadn't worked with was the venture capital and private equity group. And they're the ones who happened to have the opening when I graduated. Oh. And, you know, on the buy side, they don't do big analyst classes. It's not like they're just going to hire like 30, 40, 50 people.
Yeah.
There needed to be a head open somewhere. And the venture capital group had just promoted two analysts, two MBA analyst portfolio managers.
Mm-hmm.
And so they wanted a real analyst, someone who's not going to look to be an investment decision maker in 2 years. And so they were sort of predisposed to hiring an undergrad. And I was already there. And so I was easy due diligence for them. And so in 2001, in the beginning of 2001, I joined the venture capital and private equity group at the General Motors Pension Fund as an analyst. Mm. And GM had been invested in venture and private equity since the 70s. And all of the top Silicon Valley funds and Excel and USVP and Battery and NEA and all those guys. And so I got to meet a lot of these top investors because they used to pitch us and say, hey, you know, we're Excel, we're raising a $400 million fund. And do you guys want to re-up from your $35 or $40 million that you put in the last time around? So it was super exciting.
That's very interesting. And for context, right now, when I joined banking, our analyst class was 350.
Yeah.
So a lot more since the 50 back in the 2000s. But there's a lot of banks are a lot bigger.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people are going to finance. But that's interesting. And so you went into GM and you were effectively working as an LP and, you know, evaluating some of these, you know, technology VCs and maybe other private equity firms. You know, what was the shift into going into Union Square and deciding venture capital?
I seem to always be doing things that I said I wouldn't do. And so the thing I liked about being at GM is that I got to look at a wide variety of things. We would look at a tech VC fund specializing in, you know, I don't know, semiconductors or something like that, right? And then the next day, Blackstone would come in and say, hey, we're buying this, you know, German cable company, and would you like to do a co-investment with us? Or, TPG would say, we're going to, you know, buy Warner Music out of Time Warner, or Code Hennessy bought AMF, the bowling company. And so I know more about the economics of bowling than most venture capitalists. And so that diversity was really exciting. And so I said, wow, you know, why would anyone want to work at a single mandate fund? That's way less interesting than working in a place like GM.
Sure.
In 2004, as I was looking at emerging venture managers, I got a pitch. Actually, one of the partners at GM, Marcy Haydel, brought me in to a meeting. She knocked at my door and she said, hey, you know, I'm looking at this New York-based VC firm, and I know you've been focused on the venture stuff lately. Would you come in and check these guys out with me? And I was like, you know, groan, like, come on, it's 2004, New York venture capital, like, we're not going to do that. That's crazy town, right? What a waste of my time. I'm like the busy analyst you're throwing all your work onto, and now you want me to take this meeting.
Sure.
Well, I'm very lucky that Marcy wrote to me into taking that meeting, because it turned out to be with Brad Burnham and Fred Wilson from Union Square Ventures. And they were pitching their first fund together. And, you know, one of the biggest things I will say that has benefited my career is I took a lot of firm risk and geographic risk. And so I analyzed their fund, was really excited about it, really, really pushed hard for GM to make an investment. They ultimately decided it was too small of a fund for the kinds of checks that we were writing. And so I started talking to them about joining. And in hindsight, you know, if Union Square Ventures offered a position to any one of your listeners, they'd probably say yes, right? Yeah. But at the time, you know, nobody knew who these guys were. I mean, they were just kind of two local New York investors. Frankly, they weren't particularly connected in Silicon Valley at the time. Most of their deals were New York deals. If you think about the kinds of deals that put that firm on the map, you know, this is like pre-Twitter, right? And mm-hmm. so I think Twitter is the company that gave them a lot of their Valley street cred. And so, you know, they were previously at AT&T Ventures and Flatiron Ventures, who, you know, both were, you know, relatively local funds. You know, so I think, you know, taking a shot on a fund that no one had really ever heard of, both were single limited partner funds. So they didn't have the institutional backing or multi-institutional backing among the foundations and endowments that VCs typically have. Yeah. They just were not as well known. And then the idea to start working in New York in venture, you know, one of the best mentors I've ever had was Josh Koppelman at First Round, but I reminded Josh when he hired me in 2009 that the first time I met him back in 2005, he asked me, "What are you doing in New York? Like, why don't you go out to the Valley where all the cool stuff is happening? Like, mm-hmm. you know, this is New York is not a place to be to do venture." And that was a totally understandable perspective at the time. And so I think I'm where I am today running my own fund because I took those risks, right? It was not obvious to go work for Brad and Fred at Union Square Ventures and to take a shot on a new firm. That came through in spades because it's one of the top firms in the country.
Yeah.
But there was no competition to get into that fund. Nobody knew what it was. And there was not a lot of competition to go working in venture capital in New York in 2004. And so those two risks really paid off. And, you know, the lesson that anybody in finance knows is you don't make those kinds of outsized returns unless you take some risk.
That's very interesting. And Fred Wilson obviously is now one of the, you know, top venture capitalists mm-hmm. in Union Square Ventures. I follow his blog as well, ABC. Mm-hmm. I'm sure a bunch of my listeners do too. Mm-hmm. So how was that decision though? Because it's a, you know, a two-person startup fund. And, you know, how did you know that these guys were potentially going to, you know, make it big? Because you, mm-hmm. you must have thought about some of the return, you sure. know, from joining the fund.
Mm-hmm. I'm just that good of an investor, actually. That's, you know, I hate to brag, but I knew that those guys were going to return 25x in their first fund.
Yeah.
You know, it the thing at GM, because it was, you know, institutional limited partners are kind of academic places because they have very long-term mindsets and they do their homework, they do their research. And so they're not deal places. They're places that take a very strategic approach to different asset classes and they're very intentional about everything that they do. And so, you know, the thing I appreciated most about Union Square Ventures was that they were thesis-driven and they believed that now that, you know, everyone had all the chips and routers and bandwidth plugged in, that there would be a new wave of businesses that were sort of network-based businesses. And that made a lot of sense to me, but it also, you know, I respected the fact that they had a thesis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was interviewing a lot of other venture managers who will come in and they just say, well, you know, we have a really smart team or we have a really big network. And I'm like, well, you know, yeah, but everybody else has a really smart team and a really big network. And like, I don't understand how you generate returns when you're saying the same things as everybody else and maybe they're not. And so I liked the fact that these guys were explaining, you know, how value was going to get created in their space and appreciated that. And I think that's something that, frankly, Brad does not get enough credit for. You know, Fred is obviously the outside guy and the guy with the blog. And, you know, I think we pulled Brad into the whole blogging thing, sort of kicking and screaming a little bit. And, you know, I'll never forget the first time Brad wrote a blog on our Union Square Ventures homepage, and you know, it took him like 2 weeks or something, and it was like, "Brad, are you done with that blog yet?" And he's like, "No, it's not. it's not perfect. And Fred and I were like, just push publish, you know, it's fine. It's good. You know, you can check the spelling later. But you know, Brad is sort of a very thesis driven analytical guy. And I think, you know, he deserves a lot of credit for what they decided to go after and, you know, the sort of 10,000 foot level. You know, Fred gets into the weeds on product ideas and features and all this sort of stuff. But yeah. Brad's always like, here's the disruption that's going on in that industry and helping the firm, you know, stick to its focus. And that really, really panned out well. And so I appreciated that. And I think the other thing was just really good timing for me because I had been at GM for 4 years. There was a big gap in between like where I was as an analyst and what I could do as sort of a partner level, you know, portfolio manager kind of person. And there was kind of not a lot in between. You're sort of either a decision maker or not. And so I knew something else needed to happen. There wasn't going to be a way to sort of, you know, hang out there for 15 years to get the same level of experience that everybody else had. I thought about grad school. I applied to Stanford. I figure I'd take a shot at the one place I wanted to go to. And it seemed like every VC had either gone to Harvard or Stanford.
Yeah.
And all due respect to Boston, I'm not the world's greatest fan. It just, you know, it seems like a city not built for outsiders. I mean, I got lost driving there and you can't make the next left. The next left takes you to some completely other place. And,
yeah.
And so, and, you know, Red Sox fans are, you know, they're almost as bad as Yankee fans. And so so I decided to give Stanford a shot. Stanford didn't want me. And that was maybe the best thing to ever happen to me because I can't imagine having not worked for Union Square Ventures and not started in venture in New York in 2005 and instead coming out in 2007 as yet another MBA trying to get into venture.
Yeah.
And I've just been so much better a competitive position for having been at that firm, been at New York at that time. You know, I didn't know it would take off. I mean, I felt very positive about it, but, you know, having the halo effect from that firm, you know, really, really, gave me a big advantage out in the market.
That's great. And I mean, you touched upon this briefly, but, you know, Fred was into the details. Brad was a big picture. What was, you know, your big takeaway after 2 years? What was the your best experience or thing that you learned?
I learned a ton. I think I sort of feel like that was my MBA to some extent. And I'm not sure what value I contributed to the firm, but I did get to watch them work for 2 years and feel very lucky about that. I think I probably realized the importance of ecosystems. And I spent a lot of my time actually trying to engage the New York ecosystem more out of sort of a personal issue in that, you know, in 2005, if you were 25, 26 years old and trying to figure out like, okay, now I work in tech. Where do I go? Like, what's the next job after this? Like, who do I go work for? The community was very small. You know, again, you're pre-Twitter, you know, only the very beginnings of LinkedIn. There was just no great way to gather the community around a single point. So you just had no idea. Like, if there was a 100-person tech company down the street, like, unless you happen to walk into them or they happen to get a news story, like, you wouldn't even meet them.
Yeah.
And so I spent a lot of time building community and running events and just trying to connect to the other people doing tech in New York and did that continuously and still do that to this day. And so there's a compounding effect over the last 11 or 12 years in terms of, you know, building network here locally and realizing that, you know, the sort of rising tide lifts all ships. And so, you know, I'd like to think that, you know, one of the most helpful things I did at Union Square was help build the New York tech community and get people connected. And, you know, whether we funded them or connecting somebody with an angel or getting somebody a job or all that sort of stuff. I mean, after years and years, it has some really interesting second and third order effects in the ecosystem.
And you still do that today with, mm-hmm. I know you do your dinners and with your, you know, your blog, obviously, and, you know, you host a lot of meetups and you have your weekly newsletter. Mm-hmm. That's, I think that's really great what you're doing for the community.
It's something that, you know, as a solo GP who, you know, has one operations person on staff, everything we do has to be, has to have a synergy. And you know, has to enable us to sort of punch above our weight. And, you know, there are things that we did and also has to be replicable, right? And so there are things that we did and we said, okay, well, you know, we don't have a ton of management fees, so we can't, you know, run a lot of big events. But what if we borrowed an apartment from a host and split the cost of a chef and went around neighborhood to neighborhood? Like, would people sign up to do that? And everybody thought that was pretty cool. So we run this dinner series that's once or twice a month, and we go around all over the city. And so, yeah. You know, I had dinner with, you know, in a small group setting with probably like 350 people last year. And it really extends the network a lot. And that format came out of necessity. Actually, as a small fund, like, I can't, you know, pay for everybody's dinner at some expensive restaurant. Yeah. But, you know, going around and whether it's connecting with entrepreneurs or connecting with, you know, marketing people or developers or other investors, it just kind of gets you out there and gets you top of mind. Cause I think the thing in New York is there's a lot of money here.
Yeah.
Not all of it's venture money, but there's money, and money is your competition as an investor. And so, the key for me is how many people could I have touch points with over a long period of time where if you're in New York and you're an entrepreneur and you say, hey, I want to raise money for my seed round. Who should I talk to? I would like it to be that you don't have to throw a rock before you hit somebody who says, oh, hey, maybe you should talk to Charlie. Like, it seems like a reasonable guy. I went to his dinners or, you know, whatever. And yeah. Or I know somebody that he funded. Because I want to be able to see all of that deal flow.
Okay. And I would feel that these small dinners are probably a little bit more intimate and mm-hmm. feels a little bit more genuine than a large-scale conference dinner that maybe some of the other VCs host. So
yeah, and it's a great learning opportunity, too, especially given the diversity of industries that people are involved with in New York.
Okay. And I know that you did a little bit in starting, you know, Path 101 mm-hmm. and doing the entrepreneurship route. Mm-hmm. Probably a segue from VC to doing entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. You know, how was that experience or some of the challenges and good things that you took away?
That was awful. so it was awful for my investors. It was awful for my employees. It was hard. It was a lot harder than I thought. And, you know, I think if you looked at the, somebody should actually do this study of the track record of junior VC professionals going into entrepreneurship,
mm-hmm.
it's probably not that good, actually. I can't think of it off the top of my head, like, too many former venture people who then went into doing a startup. And not, you know, EIR types, like people who are actually analysts or principals. It feels like you learn a lot from that side, but being an operator, you know, the thing about VCs is most of us are not particularly good at anything. We're kind of a little good at a lot of different things.
Sure.
And, you know, one of the things I didn't really appreciate as a founder is being a little good at a lot of different things doesn't break you out of orbit. You know, the when you're a seed-funded founder, you know, you launch and you can't refuel in midair, basically. You have to, like, break into Earth's orbit, you know, on just your tank of gas, right? And something's going to get you there, and it's usually just like one thing, and not everything's going to be perfect, right? So you had the most amazing user interface, and, like, not a lot of people are using it yet, but you really impressed the heck out of a couple of, like, really core users. Or, you know, your product's not fully baked, but your sales team is really killing it. It's just amazing that people are paying for something where you're only 10% down the roadmap. Something has got a spark. And, you know, usually it's because the teams are particularly good at one thing. And I think that sometimes that doesn't necessarily mix well with, you know, somebody who has more of an analyst mindset who, you know, can do a wide variety of different things.
Mm-hmm.
So I wish I was a lot better at product management. And, you know, I had a great engineering team. Actually, my co-founder, my CTO, Alex Lines, is now moved over to venture and is literally sort of in the neighborhood at Notation Capital. But, you know, really, really top-tier tech team. But I don't think I guided them well enough as a product manager because I wasn't a product manager. You know, I was an armchair product manager the way a lot of VCs are. Mm-hmm. But I needed to understand better the craft of figuring out how users want to use something and how you create interfaces for them and engage them. And that was something I just didn't have the knowledge for. On top of that, the fact that we went to go raise our next round of financing the week that Lehman went under. And so I was like literally in San Francisco, like trying to pitch VCs, and it was painful. I mean, I remember this one VC who, you know, as I was talking to him, he was like, "Hey, are you looking at the market? It's a bloodbath out there." And I was like, "Well, actually, I don't really have any money, and so I'm not really looking at the market. I'm really sorry, your $20 million has just become 15, but we're actually trying to raise $250,000, and you know, it's not really working out very well. And so, you know, timing didn't help either."
Got it. And you know, I've thought about this quite a bit too. And you know, people that work in finance as a banking analyst or private equity or venture capital that want to go into the route of entrepreneurship, I feel that in these finance fields, it's a lot about perfection and making sure everything's right and following a process, which I don't think is necessarily conducive to, you know, being creative, sort of breaking things fast, failing quickly, which is what I would think needs to happen in an entrepreneurship route. I don't know. Do you think there's any way to sort of bridge that gap for people in finance that want to be an entrepreneur, or with your experience, what you would have done differently?
I think a lot of people who change careers abandon what they were coming from too much. And so, you know, somebody said, "Well, you know, I'm sick of banking. I'm getting out of this. I'm going to do something completely different."
Yeah.
Well, let's think about the assets you had when you were a banker, right? And, you know, I would recommend that anybody who works in finance and builds out those skill sets, there are businesses out there that are, you know, essentially what I call spreadsheet businesses, where they are about execution and they are about, you know, can you make this model work? I mean, can you, it was raining, so I wound up taking a car to go here, these little smart cars that are parked all over the place. And it's sort of like a Zipcar model, but you don't have to put the car back where you found it. You just sort of leave it on the street. And that is a, you know, sort of FedEx-like exercise in operational efficiency. You know, how many times does somebody need to use the car a day? How much do the cars cost us? Like, that's not a, is this a good idea or a bad idea? This is like, at what levels of usage and activity does this become a profitable business? And,
mm-hmm.
and what are my estimations of the kind of maintenance that goes into these cars, all that sort of stuff? That's a spreadsheet business. I mean, that's somebody really diving in. And I would say that kind of model overlaps very well with somebody who is doing the buyout of a bowling company and trying to figure out, you know, okay, these worst 10% performing bowling alleys, we're going to close these, or we're going to do a sale lease back, and we're going to, you know, add wait staff to the lanes and goose the margin by, you know, whatever. And so, you know, I would recommend people look at those types of models versus saying like, oh, let me create the next coolest chat app, which, as a banker, you know, I mean, if your chat app is for bankers, you know, trading fixed income or whatever, like, yeah, well, maybe that's useful. But I wouldn't necessarily recommend people abandon all the things they learned in their previous job or that skill set.
That's a very interesting insight that I haven't heard before, but I think that makes a lot of sense.
That's just what I wish I had done.
So that concludes part one of the Venture Capital episode with Charlie O'Donnell. I hope that you guys had as much fun listening to it as I did recording and interviewing Charlie. Please stay tuned for next week's episode, and till then, ciao.